Schultz.
May it please the court. This is a sentencing appeal. Trevor Lucas, a 22-year-old man suffering from mental illness with no prior record of convictions, pled guilty to a single count of 18 United States Code 924 C1A and was sentenced to 17 and a half years imprisonment, which appears to be the longest sentence ever imposed on any defendant by any court in the United States for a violation of this particular statute. The sentencing judge committed a number of serious procedural errors which contributed to a draconian, substantively unreasonable sentence. First, while paying lip service to the fact that the guideline sentence for this offense is 84 months, the sentencing judge immediately factored in the guideline range, the top guideline range for the crime of kidnapping, 87 months, added those two numbers together, 84 and 87, and then went up further from there. In effect, the sentencing judge invented his own cross-reference, a cross-reference not included in the guidelines, and he used that cross-reference that he invented not merely to supplant the original guideline, which is what most cross-references do, but in fact to more than double the original guideline. And therefore he was starting at 171 months rather than at 84 months.
That was clear. All of that is permissible in an advisory guidelines regime. In the 7-year sentence that you've referred to is the minimum, right?
The 7 years is a mandatory minimum, Your Honor, and but the reality is he effectively started at 171 months. That's what he did.
There's nothing wrong with that in an advisory guidelines regime. Well, he can make whatever, the sentencing judge can make whatever use he wants to of the old departure methodology, as long as it's reasonable in light of the facts and circumstances of the case, and this is a very aggravated case.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I don't agree with that. The first is under Gaul and its progeny, the first job of the sentencing judge is to calculate the guidelines correctly.
He did that, and he acknowledged that this is a 7-year-to-life guidelines range.
Well, Your Honor, I think what happened here is exactly what happened in the England case, where in that case the defendant had made threats from prison, and the sentencing judge speculated on that if the defendant had not been in prison, he would have carried out those threats, and therefore he started with the attempted murder guideline. And what this court said was, and the court said, A, he was wrong to start with the attempted murder guideline, but B, this court rejected the argument that the government made, which is exactly the argument that I think that you're alluding to, Judge Sykes, which is, well, the judge said that he would have gone to that same number anyway, even if the lower guideline applied. This court said that's not the point. The point is he sentenced him as an attempted murderer, and that was error. Here, this judge sentenced Trevor Lucas as though he were a convicted kidnapper. That was error. He did not have the right to do that under an advisory guideline range. He started in the wrong place.
No, he was trying to put a framework, a guidelines-related framework, on the relevant conduct of the attempted kidnapping in this case, which was charged and unequivocally based on, you know, what the conceded facts of the case are, occurred in this case as a matter of fact. And so it was fair for the judge to consider the aggravating circumstances of what was an attempted kidnapping.
Of course he can consider the circumstances,
right,
Your Honor.
And all he was trying to do was put it into a guidelines-related framework. It almost would have been better if Judge Connolly had just ignored that and imposed the sentence without trying to fit it within something in the guidelines. It seems
to me that
he was trying to do was find some guidelines support for recognizing the aggravating circumstances of the case.
But that's not authorized, and that's why no case in the country, according to Justice Kennedy's decision in O'Brien, has ever sentenced somebody to it. No one else has ever gotten a 17-and-a-half-year sentence for violating 924C.
No, the O'Brien case doesn't say that this sentence is unauthorized.
Your Honor, no, it doesn't. But it says that the court has been unable to find any case in the country where somebody got such a high sentence for 924C.
There's always a first time.
Okay. Let me turn to the second error that I submit the sentencing judge made. In applying the kidnapping guideline, he refused to take off 3 points for attempt, based on a clearly erroneous finding that all the steps necessary to complete the crime of kidnapping had been completed. That was clear error. The facts simply do not support that. Trevor Lucas, suffering from Asperger's syndrome and bipolar disorder and on a medication for Vigil, which made him manic and engaging in bizarre behaviors, was in this online internet conflict with this young man in Madison, Wisconsin. In August of 2009, he drove out to Madison. He knocked on the young man's door. The young man's mother answered, and the mother demanded identification when Trevor asked to see the young man. Trevor then pulled out a gun and pointed it at the mother. The mother screamed, shut the door in Trevor's face. Trevor went back to his car and drove back to Massachusetts. That's what happened. There was no way, based on those facts, that it could be correct for this court to say all the steps necessary for a kidnapping were completed. They were not, and that was
there. He was at the victim's doorstep, armed and with the car ready to carry a body.
Well, that's a start, Your Honor, but that's not all the steps necessary to commit a kidnapping. It just isn't.
But for the intervention of the mother.
Well, there was
no
intervention.
That would satisfy the state attempt statute, which is a lot stricter than the federal attempt statute.
I agree. It satisfies the attempt statute, but under the guidelines, he's supposed to take 3 points off for attempt unless all of the steps necessary to complete the crime were done. They were not done here. That was error. A third error.
The case law doesn't say that, though, does it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The case law does not say that with respect to these 3 points.
Your Honor, the case law says, the guidelines say, that you take off 3 points unless all the steps necessary to complete the crime were completed. They were not completed. He never even saw the person he supposedly was going to kidnap. I mean, he was a long way from a kidnapping. Yes, it was an attempted kidnapping, and there's no doubt that the sentencing judge could take that into account.
If the mother had done what he thought she was going to do.
Well, he didn't try to. He didn't shoot the mother. He didn't push his way into the house. He just left.
I realize that, but I don't think the case law requires that, does it?
Your Honor, the third mistake that I submit the trial judge made was, notwithstanding his admission that he doesn't know what would have happened if the young man had opened the door, he speculated that Trevor Lucas would have done harm to that young man, and he sentenced him in part based on that speculation. And this court has said you cannot sentence somebody based on speculation. You have to sentence based on a preponderance of the evidence. And the judge admitted, I don't know what would have happened if this young man had come to the door. That's not a basis to aggravate somebody's sentence. A fourth error the trial judge made was he said he was departing upward under 4B1.1, which authorizes an upward departure where somebody's criminal record understates their criminal history. There are two things wrong with that. Number one, Trevor had no prior convictions of any kind. And number two, the only case he had was a pending case for possession of firearms in his own home. And secondly, the guidelines specifically say, 2K2.4 says, Chapter 4 of the guidelines does not apply to this offense. So the judge erroneously applied that departure. And the fifth thing he did that was wrong was, even though he recognized that Trevor's mental illness made him incapable of understanding the significance of his conduct, a mitigating factor, he used that as an aggravating factor. And that was wrong.
Well, if he was incapable of understanding the wrongfulness of his conduct, he was not guilty.
No, Your Honor. It's very close to diminished capacity. I think, in effect, he did have diminished capacity, and diminished capacity is not an aggravating factor. It's a mitigating factor, and that's how it should have been treated.
It's a complete defense.
Well, it wasn't presented as a defense, Your Honor. The defendant pled guilty under a plea agreement where he thought he was getting something.
My only point is that the judge obviously rejected the presence of the mental illness as a significant mitigating factor here. He took it into consideration but rejected it, and it seems to me, reading the transcript, concluded that it was, in fact, an aggravating factor because
it made him
more likely to recidivate, which is hardly unreasonable.
It's unreasonable to take somebody's inability to appreciate the significance of their conduct and treat that as an aggravating factor. That's what he did. And he reached a draconian result.
This fellow was basically incurable, and he had to be incapacitated. Isn't that Only gave him 17 years.
I know, Your Honor. Why? I mean, how about if you'd given him 57 years? Would that be okay? It's draconian. It shocks the conscience for this kind of offense, given the nature of the offender, the lack of a record, the fact that nobody was hurt, and the way the judge went about doing this was wrong. And I ask the court to vacate and remand to a new judge for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Salt.
Good morning, Your Honors. Rita Rumbelow on behalf of the United States, and I did represent the United States below, too. I would like to start first with Mr. Sultan's comment that the defendant pled guilty to a plea agreement thinking that he was going to get something in return. The record is very, very clear. The plea agreement, yes, the government agreed to move to dismiss counts 1 and 2 of the superseding indictment. But throughout the plea agreement, it discussed the fact that the defendant was subjected to a mandatory minimum 7-year term of imprisonment with a maximum of life. The defendant understood that no promises regarding the sentence which would be imposed had been made to him. And by his signature on the plea agreement, he acknowledged his understanding that the sentencing court could impose anything up to the statutory maximum of life. And also in the plea agreement, the United States specifically declined to make any specific sentencing recommendation. So, yes, what he got for the plea agreement was the dismissal of counts 1 and 2. That's it. Again, I think, Judge Sykes, you understand that exactly what happened. Judge Conley went into the sentencing hearing. He repeatedly stated, I understand the guideline range is 7 years. So there wasn't any procedural error by the district court looking to the guidelines as a framework then. The judge walked in. He's like, okay, well, I can sentence anywhere from 7 years to life in prison. It is an advisory guideline scheme now. This is what we have. Under a mandatory system, things may have been different, but they're not. So when Judge Conley looked, where will I sentence this particular individual in front of me based upon all of the evidence in the record? And the Judge Conley stated repeatedly throughout the sentencing hearing that the facts were horrific. He couldn't overlook the horrific facts of this case. And he carefully considered the mitigating fact of Asperger's. He carefully considered the report from Dr. Marcus indicating that the defendant had recently started a new medication that perhaps caused this manic episode for him to drive from Wisconsin to Massachusetts. But Judge Conley's, he looks at the record as a whole. He's like, well, wait a minute. The threats to the victim, the intended victim, started a year and a half prior to this, prior to the defendant traveling to Madison. The threats started a year and a half prior to the defendant taking this medication. Judge Conley looked at the fact that the defendant has Asperger's and again, recognized it. Nobody overlooked that fact. But he's like, look, your parents have gone to great lengths to help you over the years. The defendant, great lengths. And yet the defendant still presented a danger to the community. Despite all of the efforts that his parents and other members of the community had engaged in over the years, he presented a very real danger to the community, and Judge Conley could not overlook that. You know, Judge Conley focused on not only was the defendant on bond in Massachusetts for possessing illegal weapons and not ordered to leave the state of Massachusetts, but so he violated that condition, drove to Madison, and in the interim went to a gun shop, obtained two other guns unlawfully by having his friend Straw purchase them for him. And, you know, he had all these flex cuffs, stun guns, you know, body bags, everything else in the trunk of the car, and the trunk latch had, in fact, been disabled. You know, the employee at the auto store refused to do it for the defendant, saying it was illegal, but the emergency trunk latch was disabled. And the court had photos of that, and it was part of the government's proffer at his plea hearing. So, first of all, it was not speculative for the district court to think about the harm that could have come to this intended minor victim. Not speculative at all. Look at what the defendant had in his car. Look at what was back in the woods near his home in Massachusetts. It was not erroneous for the district court to think, you know what, great harm could have and probably would have come to this minor victim had the defendant gotten his hands on him. But he didn't. The district court properly then considered the fact or didn't find Asperger's to be so mitigating to the extent that it was going to give a sentence less than 17 and a half years, considering the fact, again, that the defendant's parents had gone to great lengths to treat him over the years. And even at times, it was in the PSI, at times even the defendant's parents were afraid of him. So clearly he presented a real danger to the community. So when the district court walked in, looked at 7 years to life, properly considered all of the factors under 3553A, considered 3661, did not commit any procedural error because he recognized repeatedly that the guideline was 7 years, and then looking to all the other factors, the guidelines as a framework, the district court was in the best position to decide, I think, based on this record, that 17.5-year term of imprisonment was appropriate for this defendant, and the district court also then recommended to the Bureau of Prisons that the defendant actually not be placed in a regular prison setting, however, be placed in a mental health facility. So when you look at the record as a whole and the aggravating facts of the defendant's conduct in this case, and again, the fact that the guidelines are advisory, Judge Connolly did not commit any error in this case procedurally, and the sentence, considering he could have gone up to life of 17.5 years, is very substantively reasonable.
The suggestion of using the attempted kidnapping guideline as a reference in this case and the old upward departure methodology came from the pre-sentence writer, as I understand it. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, why are they doing that?
I would like to know also, Your Honor. I don't know.
I mean, that just invites more difficulties, it seems to me. But
it can, and hopefully, you know, it won't in the future.
But apart from that practical point, the defense counsel didn't object, as I understand it, or did he?
To what?
On the grounds that are now being argued, that there was this error in the three-point reduction and all of that kind of stuff.
Right, no. In fact, defense counsel in his sentencing memorandum didn't even address the guidelines because we all recognize the guideline was 7 years.
Right.
And so there wasn't any argument under Chapter 2 or the cross-reference to 2X1.1 because the PSI didn't even actually contain the calculations for the attempted guideline kidnapping. All it made reference to was, had the government agreed not to dismiss count two of the superseding indictment, I think it's count two, you know, he would have faced an additional 7 to 9 years in prison. It was just kind of lumped in this one paragraph.
Okay, so there wasn't actually any discussion about how that would be calculated?
No, not in the pre-sentence investigation report. It arose for the first time at the sentencing hearing.
Right, and no objection to that.
Right, because I think, I can't speak for the defense counsel, but I think the reason there wasn't an objection is because Judge Connolly said, the guideline is 7 years, and I'm essentially using the other guidelines as a framework in trying to determine where to sentence Mr. Lucas within this range.
Mm-hmm.
This information is contained in the PSRs in the Western District of Wisconsin because under a mandatory guideline scheme, and I'm thinking that this is why it hasn't changed, the PSI writer would always advise the district court whether our plea agreements undermined the statutory purposes of sentencing or undermined the mandatory guideline scheme. Even though we're now under an advisory guideline scheme, our PSIs still point out the effect on the guidelines our plea agreements have. Did I say that?
Right. No, I'm
in a sensical manner. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So I think that's why, but it was just, in a paragraph without any of the appropriate guideline calculations being done. And then they went into sentencing, and he just, again, applied it as a framework, which is perhaps why counsel didn't object. That is speculative on my part. But again, under the facts of this case and all of the evidence that the district court had in front of it, with a range of 7 years to life, the government asks that this court affirm Mr. Lucas's sentence as substantively reasonable.
Thank you. Mr. Sultan, you'd used your time, but I'll give you another minute if you'd like.
As the prosecutor correctly said, the whole issue of the kidnapping guideline came up for the first time at the sentencing hearing and I think surprised everybody. And so it's really, and I don't think that there's any fault that can be, there was no waiver of the issue. The sentence was imposed and the defendant filed a notice of appeal from that sentence. And I think all grounds on which the sentence was imposed can be properly raised. I understand that this is that the trial judges have a lot of discretion under this scheme. Their discretion is not unfettered, and that the larger the gap between the guideline range of 7 years and the sentence imposed, which is more than double that, there has to be a compelling justification. Here, there was no compelling justification. On the contrary, there were substantial mitigating circumstances that should have been taken into account. This is a sentence for a 20. 22-year-old with no prior record, who was mentally ill, where nobody was hurt, first offense, shocks the conscience, and I ask the court to vacate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.